South Sudan in focus on The Voice of America. I'm Ayen Dangbior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, November 14th, 2019. South Sudan reacts to the U.S. decision to reevaluate its relations with the government.
Respecting the facts on the ground, of course, and the decision taken by the leadership of the country, people say it is okay.
And the SPLM-IO weighs in on the U.S. announcement.
This balance touching does not help peace process in South Sudan. We are implementing an agreement. And what the United States government needs to do is to evaluate the agreement itself before evaluating its bilateral relations with South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government says it's disappointed that the United States feels the need to reevaluate its relations with the government after it and other parties failed to adhere to the November 12th deadline to form a unity government. The Trump administration questioned the suitability of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar to continue to lead South Sudan's peace process. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesman Ambassador Mayuen McCall says the decision to delay formation of South Sudan's unity government was made in good faith.
Respecting the facts on the ground, of course, and the decision taken by the leadership of the country, people say it is okay. It is a good decision because there is no way we can push for the things that will generate more problems, more conflicts. There are things on the ground that is not accomplished, and this has now given chance for these 100 days so that people work on them very hard so that they are implemented before we go for the new government.
McCall says disappointments expressed by other governments such as the U.S. do not offer solutions to achieving peace in the country.
There are technical issues that go beyond anybody's imagination, and there is no doubt that failure to form the government on the 12th of November is not good. The leadership in the opposition and the government are doing their best with the support of the people of South Sudan to be able to work together to form the government in the time given.
The U.S. State Department statement says the South Sudanese party's failure to respect the November deadline presents a question on the current political leader's suitability to lead the peace process. The U.S. says it will reevaluate its relations with South Sudan and take more measures to deal with those who obstruct peace in the country. McCall says the United States should be patient as the South Sudanese parties work to restore lasting peace in the country.
We had six months,
and now we have 100 days. So hopefully this is going to be the last for us to be able to form the government and bring a lasting peace in the country.
The U.S. statement indicates a difference of opinion from other stakeholders. The regional bloc, IGAD, the United Nations, and South Sudanese civil society activists have welcomed the 100-day delay and have called on the parties to make every effort to address the outstanding issues, mainly security arrangements and the number of states and their boundaries. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
An official with the SPLM-IO says the United States and other members of the Troika should participate fully in implementing the revitalized peace deal by giving South Sudan resources rather than just blaming the parties. Stephen Parkwal, SPLM-IO Secretary for Foreign Affairs, who is in Washington, D.C. at the moment, calls the U.S. ignorant about what is being done to implement the peace process and says if he gets a chance to meet with U.S. officials, he would urge the U.S. to get involved in the peace process.
First of all, this balance touching does not help peace process in South Sudan. We are implementing an agreement. And what the United States government needs to do is to evaluate the agreement itself before evaluating its bilateral relations with South Sudan. First of all, the United States government refused to sign this agreement as one of the guarantors. And look at what they are saying, which is also against the traditional norm of diplomatic relations. We as a liberation movement do not have bilateral relations with the United States. So this is an affair between Juba and Washington. So what is it that is being said here that the United States will reevaluate bilateral relation with South Sudan? South Sudan has a government, one government, under President Salva Kiir, and it is here represented in Washington, D.C. by the Embassy of the Republic of South Sudan. Where does the SPLM-IO come in?
While that may be true, that the SPLM-IO may not have diplomatic relations with United States, yet your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, signed the peace agreement. And so far, he has failed to keep his part of the agreement.
That is not true. We have done our part. And the problem with the United States is that the United States is intentionally ignorant of what is being done to implement the agreement. Otherwise, it would know what the SPLM-IO and the SPLM-IO leadership has done to make sure that this agreement is implemented.
The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, says that the failure of your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, and President Salva Kiir to form this government calls into question their suitability to continue to lead South Sudan. Do you think your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, is suitable to be a leader?
Yes, Dr. Riek Machar has been playing a leadership role until this point in time. And these things that you need Riek Machar and Salva Kiir out of the system is also misplaced, because Riek Machar has no regime in South Sudan is running now. There is only the government of the day responsible for the resources, responsible for diplomatic, bilateral diplomatic relation between the United States and South Sudan.
You are in Washington. Do you plan to meet with U.S. government officials, for example, from the State Department?
No, we have not met anybody yet here. But if we get the opportunity to meet one, we will explain to them and we will urge them actually to participate in the peace implementation process and take correct observation of what is happening instead of bashing both parties and speak of this language like double regime change or something like that. It doesn't help at this time. Our leadership in the Sudan need support from the Western government, especially the United States, to implement this agreement and account each party individually, saying that all our leaders have done this together or have failed to do this together is not helping us. We are parties, and not only the SPLM-IO and the SPLM and the government, there are also other parties that have signed this agreement. And the United States, the TRICA, and the UN, instead of just blaming the parties, need to participate practically in the implementation process by providing support, resources, and critical evaluation of the process.
That was Stephen Parr Kwol, SPLM-IO Secretary for Foreign Affairs. He was speaking in Washington to my colleague James Butte last night. The head of South Sudan's delegation at a global summit on health in Nairobi this week made commitments to increase the country's budget allocation for health care by 15% in order to reduce the high rate of mother and child mortality by 2030. World leaders attending the conference are making commitments to end preventable maternity deaths, increase family planning, and stop violence against women and girls. Winnie Torino has more for VOA from Nairobi, Kenya.
South Sudan's Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Jemanu Nkumba, who represented South Sudan at the International Conference on Population Development, says her government has trained 800 midwives to reduce maternal mortality rates in the country.
To achieve universal sexual and reproductive health and rights, we commit to train and deploy at least 3,900 more midwives by 2030 and achieve 10% contraceptive prevalence rate by 2020. And increasing to at least 30% by 2030. Establish family planning and adolescent and youth-friendly services in all health facilities by 2021. Fully implement age-appropriate life skills and sexuality education in all primary and secondary schools by 2025.
Kumba says her government is committed to allow unimpeded access to humanitarian agencies to provide basic social services, including sexual and reproductive health, to areas affected by gender-based violence due to the conflict in South Sudan. She says the government will come up with the funds needed to bolster South Sudan's health sector.
We commit to increase budget allocation for the health sector from the current 1% to 5% of the annual national budget in the fiscal year 2020-2021, graduating to 15% by 2030 in line with the Abuja Declaration, and establish the Maternal Mortality Reduction Fund by 2022.
Komba vowed that the government will put in place enforcement mechanisms to end the age-old problem of child marriage in South Sudan.
To end child marriage in all states by 2020, we commit to enact gender-based violence law by mid-2020 and establish specialized gender-based violence courts by 2021. Enact the Family Law and Children Act by 2022. Establish the Women Development Fund by fiscal year 2021-2022.
Natalia Kanem, Executive Director of United Nations Population Fund, says maternal mortality rates has fallen to 44% since world leaders met in Cairo in 1994. She says governments and their partners should do more to address challenges facing maternal health in Africa. She says all too often, underage girls are forced to marry older men, and women and girls are sexually abused across the world.
The way forward is by focusing on one number only. And for UNFPA, that number is zero. Zero unmet need for contraception, so that every woman and adolescent girl decides for herself whether, when to get pregnant, how many children to have. Zero preventable maternal deaths, so that no woman will have to die for want of reproductive care. And zero gender-based violence. Zero cases of female genital mutilation. Zero forced and child marriages.
Leaders and civil society activists from around the world came here to make concrete commitments to meet women's demands and stop violence against women and girls by the year 2030. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Nairobi, Kenya.
The founder of a Malawian maternity clinic for poor women says it has set a record delivering more than 8,800 babies without a single death of mother or child. For her efforts to improve access to safe childbirth, Charity Salima has become known as Malawi's Florence Nightingale, the English founder of modern nursing. Lamek Messina has this report from Lilongwe.
Grace Chakudza gave birth in November to a healthy baby boy, her fourth child, at Achikondi Community Clinic. It opened in 2008 to help poor women safely give birth. Since then, the clinic has performed more than 8,800 successful deliveries without the loss of a mother or a child, according to its founder. That's a record number in Malawi, where the United Nations Children's Fund says the average mortality rate per 1,000 births is 22 deaths for babies and 6 for mothers. Chakudza appreciates the care she got from the clinic. She says there is a big difference. There is congestion in public hospitals. Women give birth on the floor, and sometimes one nurse is responsible for 3 pregnant mothers. This compromises the health of mothers and children. But here, I received good treatment. The number of successful deliveries reported by the clinic means it beats not only the global average of 17 newborn deaths per 1,000 births, but also the average of rich nations. Britain this year gave clinic founder Charity Salima the Commonwealth Points of Light Award, calling her Malawi's Florence Nightingale, the English founder of modern nursing. Salima credits the way the clinic handles the medical emergencies.
All that success has come in because we can live aware there is a complication as soon as possible. Early detection of any abnormality and any referral. That is what makes us to be successful.
The clinic is free of charge, and the building, constructed by donations from Scotland and the Norwegian Nurses Organization, the US-based charity Freedom from Fistula Foundation, which helps treat the childbirth injury, funds the clinic. Lita Kaunda is the community leader at Area 23, where the clinic is situated. She says before this clinic, many pregnant mothers were giving birth on their way to the hospital because of the distance they were traveling. Despite their reputation, Salima says the clinic does have challenges.
sometimes we lack resources. It could be financial resources. We don't have much resources. We would also want, if we could have this building, like have a solar electricity, because sometimes electricity is on and off.
Salima hopes the clinic will get additional support and do even more to reduce Malawi's newborn and maternal deaths. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A doctor in Bor says they have no more drugs to treat patients with several diseases. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite month of the year? Why?
Should be November. I think that's when I get something like that, clients and money as well.
My favorite month of the year is December, where we have a lot of festivities, the birth of Christ, and it's also the end of the year where we have every cause to thank God.
My favorite month of the year is April, because I got married on 18th of April, then I also gave birth on 24th of April.
Well, I like December because it's the ending of a complete year, and we look forward to new beginnings.
Most of the time, good things come in April, that's what I'll say. I see April as the lucky month.
I'll say February because it's my birth month. Makes me feel loved, makes me feel that people care about me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The director of Bor Hospital in Jonglei State says the hospital has run out of life-saving drugs due to a large influx of patients suffering from various diseases. Dr. Bol Chow says cases of malaria, typhoid, pneumonia, and dysentery are on the rise due to recent widespread floods across the state. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Dr. Chow says Bor Hospital receives about 400 new patients per day, many of whom are diagnosed with malaria, typhoid, fever, dysentery, and pneumonia. He says doctors are advising patients to buy medicine from private clinics, seeing the hospital's supply has dried up. 28-year-old Yara Liersant was diagnosed with malaria, pneumonia, and dysentery last week when he was admitted to Bor Hospital. Speaking in Dinka, Alier says she had to buy medicine for her son from a private clinic in Bor town.
I brought my son to the hospital here on November 6, but there are no drugs at the hospital. The doctors told me to go and buy the drug from a private clinic at the market. I have bought some drug and others are expensive and I could not afford.
Alier says she cannot afford to keep buying the prescription drugs her son needs. 17-year-old Akir Guy was admitted at Bor Hospital last week. Speaking in Dinka, Guy says the doctors told her the hospital had run out of drugs to treat her malaria and typhoid, and recommended she buy prescription drugs from a private clinic.
All the drugs for my treatment are being bought from a private clinic, and then I am being injected here in the hospital by the doctor. Even if there are no drugs here in the hospital, the doctors here are more trustworthy than this from the business private clinic.
Dr. Chow says the hospital faces many challenges after running out of drugs to treat patients from Bor town and elsewhere suffering from waterborne diseases.
This has led actually to increased number of admissions, especially the children, and which on a daily basis, even if you give them drugs, but there is still influx of patients. So this leads to depletion of stock within a short time.
Dr. Shao says his hospital receives its medical supplies, including medicine from the National Health Ministry in Juba. He says Bor Hospital has not received a new shipment of medicine for about 6 months. It did not explain the reason for the lack of drugs at the hospital. The National Health Minister, Dr. Yagai, says his ministry is facing challenges of transporting medical supplies to the flood-affected areas across the country.
Some areas in Jomule, because of this flooding, difficult with accessibility, but the supplies are there.
Guy says his ministry is working with UNICEF to send drug supplies to Bor and other flood-affected areas. Last month, President Salva Kiir declared a state of emergency in most of the areas affected by the floods. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, or IFRC, says about 2 million people are facing severe food insecurity in Mozambique. It says $7 million are needed to help them. More than half a year since Cyclone Idai and Kenneth hit the country, thousands of people are at risk of disease outbreaks and worsening food availability in the upcoming rainy season. And nearly 38,000 children are at risk of malnutrition. For VOA, Mavis Oshere spoke with Raul Oliveira, the IFRC operations manager in the Mozambican capital, Maputo.
The situation is dire at the moment. As you know, I mean, the impact of the cyclone was not just on infrastructure and shelters, but it actually destroyed most of the crops. So people couldn't harvest this year and have been without any substantial agriculture for the past month. This is particularly critical because 80% of the people in Mozambique depend directly from agriculture to get their food on the table. So the situation is deteriorating in terms of food insecurity, and we are very concerned that particularly children may be starting to be affected with malnutrition. So this is something that we need to act on the immediate term by having food distributions in the most affected areas, as well as recovering the agriculture inputs for the planting season until the rainy season starts. On the other hand, we also have concerns around the health situation. Back in March, we had a cholera outbreak that was somehow quickly contained, but the sanitation and the hygiene situation for most of the displaced populations is not a good one at this moment. So this population is still living in improper and inadequate shelters with lack of sanitation, which may be prone as well to new outbreak situations. So it's something that we've been looking at, monitoring, ready to act, but it needs to be scaled up as the rainy season starts.
So currently, how many people are affected or risks being food insecure in Mozambique?
So in the central region only, where the cyclones hit, we have now 2 million people that are affected by food insecurity. And food insecurity has several levels. So they are getting into the moderate to high food insecurity now, and the situation may deteriorate in the coming months. Again, these are only the numbers for the cyclone affected areas in central Mozambique. But the information that we've gathered is that about 38,000 children are at risk of malnutrition.
But the International Federation of Red Cross, led by Dr. Jamila Mahmoud, was in Mozambique to kind of assess the situation. What are some of the interventions so far?
So we are doing water and sanitation interventions in areas that are most exposed to this risk of the health outbreaks. We've been doing this continuously since March, and we are scaling up this operation as the rainy season starts. We are also doing food distributions now during the lean season. At the same time, we distribute agricultural seeds and tools so people can start their self-recovery and rebuild the agriculture. The amount that is needed for the Federation appeal and in support to the Mozambique Red Cross particularly, it's now $7 million in the next immediate month, so in the next 3 months for this response. Overall, there is a humanitarian community appeal. The movement has put in substantial resources already, but the needs are so big that the amounts that we currently have are not enough to attend all these population that are in need.
That was Rue Oliveira, the Red Cross Operations Manager in Maputo, speaking with VOA's Mavis Okiere. Security authorities in Ugandan districts bordering Rwanda have banned traders from unnecessarily traveling into Rwanda through unguarded border crossings. This follows an incident Sunday when Rwandan defense forces near the border fired on 5 Ugandans, killing 2. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Since the Rwanda-Uganda border was closed 10 months ago, border communities on both sides have devised ways to trade over unguarded border crossings. Life had gone on normally until the killings on Sunday, which have sparked fear among residents in the border communities. Rwanda's government says the people its forces shot at on Sunday were illegally smuggling tobacco across the border. Uganda this week placed security officers on the border on high alert to arrest any Ugandan trying to sneak goods into Rwanda to prevent new clashes with Rwandan security forces. Prekeria Muhindo Mwine is the Ruchiga resident district commissioner and is in charge of security in the district.
You know, smuggling is a criminal offense in Uganda. So we are going to emphasize that law. We are going to waken up our police officers at the border. If they see anybody smuggling anything across the border to Rwanda, they should have him arrested so that he is prosecuted. Otherwise, if you want to take anything to Rwanda, let them use the official borders.
Strained relations between Uganda and Rwanda led to the border closure. Rwanda also has barred its nationals from crossing into Uganda, accusing its neighbor of jailing Rwandans and holding them incommunicado. While Ugandan authorities view the shootings as the result of the tense relationship, Rwanda's government says the 2 were killed after they tried to violently resist security forces during arrest. David Claudian Mushabe is the mayor of Nyagatare district in Rwanda. He was among the officials who returned the bodies of the Ugandan nationals.
When police officers tried to stop the smugglers, they refused and eventually, violently, they had wanted even to kill the police officers. So what happened in self-defense, of course, police shot dead 2 of them. Besides that, to me, I can say it is very unfortunate, though there is a lesson to learn. They should not be violent, those who smuggle. And also they should know that there are some gazetted areas that they should be using when they are going for businesses.
But Muhindo protests the shooting.
And I want to condemn the killing. People should be arrested and put to prison. Killings don't solve problems. Let us maintain the relationship which has been between Uganda and Rwanda, because we are actually neighbors, we are even relatives.
In a protest note to Kigali, Ugandan authorities say the alleged crime does not justify shoot at unarmed civilians residing along the border. Uganda has called for a joint investigation of the killings to bring the perpetrators to justice. About 2 weeks ago, a Rwandan national was shot and severely wounded on Rwandan territory while bringing potatoes from Uganda. A second meeting on reopening the border, it has been pushed to November 18th, but no reason has been given. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Ya Salam by Emmanuel Jal. We've been listening to the song Ya Salam. I'm Ayen Dengbior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Darba Salam, Azhar, Uful.
سلام أزهر وفل واقع صبح